You're listening to Idaho Matters. I'm Gemma Gaudette. Well, happy Friday to you. And if you are a regular listener, you know that on Fridays it is our reporter roundtable. This is when we get you updated on the news that made headlines around our region this week. Our panel today, Mike Sharp with KIVI 6 on your side, Don Day with BoiseDev.com, and Heath Drusen with Boise State Public Radio and Guns and America. Welcome. Happy Friday.
Weekly journo party.
I know, right? Right here. Right here. You know, it's where the fun begins. Speaking of fun, you know, once again, we have got a mayor and a former mayor making headlines in the city of Boise. This time, Don, around CCDC. Can you kind of give us some backstory on that and then where we are now?
So the Capital City Development Corporation was funded as the Boise Redevelopment Agency in 1968.
We're going back that far. That is good to know for people who have recently moved here, wondering what CCDC is.
Yeah, it's been around.
Okay, we're gonna skip forward like 40 years. Okay.
So, the CCDC is made up of seven panelists that are nominated by the mayor of Boise, and currently, it has six members, all nominated by former mayor Dave Beter. One member stepped off. New mayor Lauren McLean this morning announced that she will make three nominations to the board. It can expand to nine members, and she's electing to do that. The most prominent member that she's hoping to appoint is herself. During the campaign, she said that she didn't intend to be on the CCDC board, which was a break from Mayor Beter's past practice. It's important to note this isn't super uncommon. Tammy DeVeard was on the Meridian Development Corporation board, but she said, I don't see any reason to be there. She changed course after the new year and after she was sworn in when former Mayor Beter said, I'm not leaving. Actually, he hasn't said that. I should be fair. He hasn't said that, but he's not leaving.
and his term goes through
2022.
Right.
Yeah. So he's actually got the longest term. So he appears that he intends to stay on the board. Now, there's been some back and forth. McLean said, and I reported a couple of weeks ago, that she would nominate herself if Beter didn't step off. At a news conference this week, Lauren McLean said that the mayor wouldn't talk to her by phone, but would only come in and have a meeting in person. But Mayor Beter said, I want to bring somebody, and wouldn't say who that was. And she said, well, that I'm not going to do that. You have to say who you're going to bring, just as anybody would. So today she put out the nominations and said she's going to nominate herself. She had told me a couple weeks ago, quote, if I have to appoint myself to the commission, I will. If there's a mayor on the board, it should be the current one. CCDC needs to align with the vision of a city. She's also nominating two additional folks. The first is Kate Nelson, who is the Director of Economic Opportunity at Janus, and Latonia Keith, who is the interim dean of the what is currently known as the Concordia School of Law here in Boise. So those nominations will go up to the city council for approval this Tuesday. If the council body approves them, they would be seated for the CCDC commission on March 9th. And it'll be an interesting time. I won't be there for another commitment, but other reporters will be in the room, I'm sure, and you'll see some dynamics between mayors past and present.
Well, and we should say, right, that the CCDC rules, if I'm remembering this correctly, Don, a former mayor can sit on the board, correct?
For now. The Idaho State Legislature is considering legislation that would do what they call a fix and would boot any elected official off of an Urban Renewal Commission statewide after their term in office ends, either if they leave voluntarily or if they're booted out of office. That would impact a number of people, including Mayor Beter, Marianne Jordan, who's currently on the CCDC panel, Ben Quintana, who's currently on the CCDC panel, and Mayor Tammy DeVeard on the Meridian Development Corporation panel. We'll see if that legislature makes it through. It's bundled up with one other element on eminent domain there. But if it does, it would theoretically make another major shift in that panel's makeup.
Is it fair to say that Mayor McLean reneged in a way on a campaign promise when she said she would not seat herself on CCDC?
Yeah, it's for sure fair. In fact, she told me in an interview after the general election and before the runoff that, you know, this is just kind of the way panels work. People are nominated to them and they serve out and they do their work. I haven't asked for this, and in the next news conference, actually, I should. But I believe that this is a result of a very fractured transition process. The mayor, former mayor, wouldn't meet with her. There was some other kind of stuff back and forth. We talked here a week ago about a former beater aide who was paid severance for working for about 3 weeks, and some other issues with the transition. So I think a bloody political season followed by a really fractured
A contentious divorce, shall we say?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know that the gendered term is always the best there, but it there definitely is some strife between these two politicians.
And another thing that has had a lot of controversy, in fact, I mean, I think it's fair to say that some would argue it is the reason why former Mayor Dave Beater lost the election, and this is the future of the Boise Library.
Yeah, so Mayor McLean yesterday had a day-long series of meetings with the Friends of the Boise Library, the Library Commission, the library staff, Boise Working Together, and I think one other group. It was like five different meetings. And the end of that was with the library board, and it was open to the public. And she talked at length, reiterating her campaign promise that she was deeply committed to the library. In her words, with Boise Working Together, she said that they discussed the intent of that ballot language that would require a future vote for the library. And I think they're trying to work through how to do this because the ballot language kind of makes it seem like the city can't work on a library at all, including preparing a project to put to vote. And so they're trying to figure out how they would adjust that right now. We'll see more on this right now. Yesterday was kind of incremental, so I actually didn't write a story on it, but I think that there will be more to develop. But McLean says, yeah, we need a new downtown library, but we really need to talk to all the stakeholders about how we do that. The former plan, $110 million plus, that involved Safdie Architects, was actually put on pause by former Mayor Beater last year. It remains on pause, and I don't think we're going to see much of that plan in the future.
There is actually news that happened outside of Boise this week. So let's talk about that. Mike, a marriage license bill, it is in the State House right now. And my understanding is that this bill could defund some assistance.
Right. So the bill itself is actually dead now because of partially because of this news that came out of the legislation. And I mean, I can't say whether or not it was accidental or purposeful. It's just one of those things that happens in state government. The way this organization was funded and the name of the organization is it's related to domestic violence. It is the Idaho Council on Domestic Violence and Victim Assistance. And so the way they're funded is they receive $15 from marriage certificates or marriage licenses. And this legislation would change the way the state administers marriage licenses by getting out of the marriage license game and allowing counties to handle marriage certificates, which would it seems like a non-important designation, but this organization loses pretty much all of its funding. And this organization is one of the few organizations that's receiving state funding specifically related to domestic violence. So they were sounding the alarm. They wrote letters to the Jude and Rules Committee saying, hey, this is something that would be very detrimental to our organization. They let us know that this was a concern within the legislation. We confirmed that the language was in the legislation that they had an issue with. But yeah, it ended up the legislation is, once again, it's one of those bills that's sitting in committee that won't move forward in this legislative session. But it's something to watch for the next.
And then, Heath, let's talk about what's going on with a concealed carry bill in the State House. But first, talk to us about what the law is right now in the state of Idaho.
Right. So right now we have a very, very, not a very restrictive concealed carry policy. So any Idaho resident can carry concealed or open carry pretty much wherever they want outside of certain places that you'd expect, like federal buildings, things like that. But the law does not apply to U.S. citizens who do not live in Idaho. So that's what this law is aimed at, as aimed at changing. it's aimed at basically expanding concealed carry to any U.S. citizen, and there's a few non-citizen residents, like members of the military who aren't yet U.S. citizens, things like that. But it's mostly basically every American in Idaho can carry concealed wherever they want, in city limits or out. So this is kind of one of the few remaining regulations left.
And so where is the bill right now in the process?
So the bill just passed the House, but there was some drama in the committee hearing. In the committee hearing earlier this week, when a grandfather walked in with his daughter to testify in favor of the bill.
My name is Charles Nielsen. This is my granddaughter, Bailey. Bailey is 11 years old. Bailey is carrying a loaded AR-15. People live in fear, terrified of that which they do not understand. She's been shooting since she was 5 years old. She got her first deer with this weapon at 9. She carries it responsibly. She knows how not to put her finger on the trigger. We live in fear in a society that is fed fear on a daily basis.
This was during a hearing.
Yes, this was the State Affairs Committee. And for those who didn't see the video of it, this 11-year-old girl had an AR-15 rifle.
Loaded.
Apparently loaded, slung across her shoulder, and she was standing next to her grandfather.
So I'm curious about how she was able to go into the State House with this. I mean, I know you can bring guns in, but she's under the age of 18.
Right. And I got a lot of questions about that, about sort of, well, wait a second. I know it's Idaho, but is that legal for a child to carry a loaded AR-15? And the answer is sometimes. So the way the law is written, if you are under 18, you are allowed to possess a weapon if you have written permission by your parent or guardian, or are accompanied by a parent or guardian while carrying the weapon. So I'm not casting aspersions on the grandfather there at all. I have no idea what the guardianship situation is, or maybe written permission. That's
neither here nor there, frankly.
Right. So if one of those two is met, then that's perfectly fine. What she can't do, according to the law, is just kind of walk around on her own with a loaded weapon. But it appears that might have been within the law what happened at the committee hearing.
What was the reaction? I'm curious to know, even as a lawmaker, right, where you're sitting there in it's a hearing, but you know, there's someone there with a loaded AR-15. I mean, what was the feel of that?
So that's what's really striking to me. And actually, listeners can go back and find the archive video and the legislature site. But there really wasn't much reaction. It was really quiet, and the camera was on the chairman, Representative Harris, and he didn't have much of a reaction. He kind of took it in stride. Reminded the speaker to please address the committee members, and everything was very sort of matter of fact, to be honest. And I guess it's a different reality here in Idaho than other places.
And having covered the legislature for many years, pretty much any gun legislation will bring out individuals that are packing heat and openly packing heat. The age of this individual was different, and I think that's what made the story so unique, were these questions that surrounded it. But it's important to remember, too, that it's actually kind of difficult in the state of Idaho to confirm those details about registration and those things when somebody's wearing a gun, because you can't just openly question them, right? A security guard has limitations on the questions you can just ask somebody, right? Like, you have to have a probable cause to start that process. The state and the state legislature are very openly supportive of these individuals who show up in support of the Second Amendment. And in fact, many of the legislators are also carrying weapons at any given time. So it's an interesting dynamic. You mentioned it's a different reality here living in Idaho. It's a weird feeling to be in a legislative hearing where there is something that is very obviously different from every other hearing, and yet nobody seems to mention that very different thing.
Right. That's a big elephant in the room. Our panel today, Mike Sharp with KIVI, Six on Your Side, Don Day with BoiseDev.com, and Heath Drusen with Boise State Public Radio and Guns in America. Mike, just yesterday, we talked with Representative Megan Blanksma on our program about a bill that is sitting in committee, and it's regarding surprise medical billing. But tell us more about this, because there are folks that have a different take on this bill than she does.
Yeah, it's really interesting. So, I mean, many people have been in the situation, or you know somebody who has. Maybe you go to the emergency room, you have an issue. The emergency room is in a hospital that is in network, but they are contracting a doctor who is not in network, who then is the person who sees you. So you end up with what they call surprise billing. You end up with this bill that's just monstrously beyond what you expected when you went into the emergency room in the first place. There's an expectation that doctors will let you know the max out of pocket before you go through the process of receiving that medical care. But in emergency situations especially, that's really hard to pull off. And so this legislation would try to mandate that doctors, that if you are in network, that you can bill in network in order to help those individuals who would be affected by this. However, it's not that cut and dry. So if you call 911 and an ambulance shows up to your house and you're not awake, how do they have that conversation with you to confirm which
– and they're going like to
the nearest
not.
Hospital.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Like that's just the way it works. That's emergency situations in reality. So there are questions regarding the legislation. They go deeper into the debate of, you know, obviously medical professionals are pointing the fingers at insurers, and insurers are pointing the fingers at medical professionals. And it's a unique situation where both really do want the situation resolved. There's some concern that maybe insurers want to bill at a certain rate so that it's easier for them, and the doctors maybe want to try to sneak this on individuals. And when in reality, of course, that's not the case. These are just doctors being doctors and people being people, and they're getting caught in the middle.
And that was part of it, right, in the story that you guys did too, about maybe kind of a lack of, did you say a lack of coverage? Or, I mean, there's that kind of gap, like you said.
Right, right. And I mean, any insurance has that, right? When you step outside of network, it opens up a whole other door of your coverage. And I mean, I can tell you from my insurance, I don't know those things, right? Like I intentionally choose the places I go to because they are in network. And so when those things do happen, it's your mind gets blown. And then you start the process of making the phone calls to your insurer and making the phone calls to the provider and trying to alleviate some of those costs. And it's very difficult, if possible at all.
But this bill is basically sitting in committee, right?
The bill is sitting in committee. It sounds like there may be a hearing next week.
And this is different than, we should say, than this. There's another bill that's about the whole medical billing transparency.
Right.
And that's kind of farther along in the process.
Right, right. Medical billing transparency is a whole other beast.
So Don, I mean, being part of Boise Dev, I mean, you are constantly keeping your finger on the pulse of what is happening from a development standpoint. A big building at 11th and is it Idaho? I go by it almost every day. It's going up fast in downtown Boise.
Yeah, so this is, to orient yourself, it's right across from the Record Exchange and right next to the El Cora Shrine Temple. This is put together by Raffinelli and Nahas, and it's going to be a nine-story office project. And they just started building, it feels like yesterday.
But it's fast.
It was last year. And they are on steam and ahead for a Thanksgiving open. The building has topped out. It's as high as it will be, which is nine stories plus a rooftop deck. And a neat, you know, you might be listening going, an office project? I don't care, man. But it's going to open up onto a park that's going to be a partnership between the developer, the City of Boise, and the aforementioned Capital City Development Corporation. And this park's going to have a large art feature, some larger trees. I think we've talked about this on Idaho Matters before. It's going to sort of provide an oasis in the downtown area on what is or what was a service parking lot. Mm-hmm. And they're also going to have some retail spaces on this park that they're hoping to get some food vendors for. No tenants signed for this building yet, but I actually worked on a story today that we'll publish Monday about the office market in Boise, and it's as tight as it's been in 20 years. So there definitely seems to be demand for additional office space, especially in the downtown core.
And this building, too, seems to, I mean, kind of expand downtown Boise. I mean, because that was really kind of the edge of you know, maybe that downtown core.
Yeah, before. I walked over, and the reason I did the story, just I happened to walk over to a meeting at the Record Exchange in their little coffee shop, and I remember thinking that used to be a long ways away, and it's really not. It's brings the core together, and I'll just say I'm working on a couple of stories in the downtown area that will continue to expand the definition of downtown, both horizontally and probably vertically. So there's a lot coming in the next year in downtown Boise. After what really was a very quiet 2019, there wasn't a lot of projects that got off the ground, but I think 2020 and 2021 are going to be huge years in downtown Boise.
Well, especially if you even look at like 6th and...
Oh, 6th Street's a mess. I work on 5th on Capitol.
We're down to one lane of traffic.
One lane and the sidewalks are closed and there's buildings and there's projects and so there's a lot going on, and I think you'll see more of that. It really... the boom of the last couple of years in Boise, it has definitely impacted downtown Boise, but I think we're at a level where maybe construction costs are tapering enough that we're going to see some things get off the ground.
And then from a local business development, we're seeing growth in certain businesses, like Guru Donuts just said that they are opening on Eagle Road.
Yeah, chatted with them. They're going to open a second location. They had new owners about a year ago, and that second location will be out by Intuit/T-Sheets on Eagle Road in Eagle. So we're going to see that coming here hopefully by summer for them.
And then what sushi restaurant
Paddles Up Poke. So okay. These guys are, they're just on fire. I talked to them in December about their new store at Boise State, which opened in January.
And then, I didn't even know they had that one.
Right. And then Dan Landucci sends me an email a couple weeks ago. He's the owner and says, hey, we've got a 5th store we're working on. I was like, you just opened 4th.
I thought there was like only one or two.
So Paddles Up Poke has a location on 9th Street in Boise.
Right.
They have a location on Main Street in Ketchum. They have a location at Eagle and McMillan. They have the new Boise State store. And the 5th store will be in Nampa. I actually just walked by it last night by 2C Family Brewing and Mesa Tacos out in Nampa. So, and he says he's not done. He may do more. And so that's a really interesting local success. We just launched a new vertical on Boise Dev called Get Local, following all these budding local businesses, and there's a lot of them right now.
You know, speaking of Nampa and where that location is going to be, and Mike, you know this, working at Channel 6. I worked at Channel 6 for years, and before that, Fox 12, when it was kind of a desert in Nampa. And, I mean... when you see this part of downtown Nampa and you see 2C Brewing and you've got what, Holy Cow, and you've got Mesa Tacos, and there's what, a Pre-Funk.
Boise Fry Company.
There's really a turn happening in Nampa downtown area.
There was a time when we would have reporters and interview candidates come into town that we would exclusively take them to lunch and dinner in Boise. It's just not the case anymore. It's a really cool environment. The downtown area in general has been developed in a really clean and attractive way, and it's really appealing to be able to take people to these restaurants that didn't exist like 3 years ago.
Well, and I'm a Southeast Boise guy. I grew up on the Boise bench. I've always been a Boise person, and I used to think of Nampa as a long way. I used to think of Meridian as a long way away, but I used to think of Nampa as a long way away. And my wife and I will drive out to Nampa to go to Mesa Tacos. And part of it was living in California for 10 months, which resets your expectations of far. We'll just say that. But it's amazing how much is out there and what's going on. And I think we're going to see more.
And parking is still free downtown Nampa.
It's easy.
Yeah. Our panelists, Mike Sharp with KIVI 6 on your side, Heath Drusen with Boise State Public Radio and Guns in America, and Don Day with BoiseDev.com. Mike, KIVI 6 on your side, you have a continuing series called Finding Hope. And this time you've been looking at the Valley View schools. Talk to us about what they're doing when it comes to really trying to fight teen suicide.
Yeah, so this story goes back. So it actually goes back about a year ago. I received a phone call. A couple individuals reached out to me and said that Valley View School District was having a situation where there was an uptick in suicides of students. I reached out to the school district and they said, look, we're not talking publicly about this. Suicides are really delicate. Anybody who works in news knows. It's not an easy thing to cover, and you have to cover it in a very unique and specific way. And they were telling me that there were strategies that they were working on looking into the future, and they asked to get a few months to kind of get those underway before they start talking about them, because what they wanted to focus on was the solutions and not just the problem, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. So they were working on those issues last year. Fast forward to this year, I was covering the Barbara Ehart legislation that was related to, or sorry, not her legislation, but legislation that was in her committee that she made some remarks related to about social emotional learning for teachers. The idea being that the State Department of Education wants to fund training for teachers so that they can recognize signs and deal with situations better, to forward these students onto counselors and make sure that these students are finding help before they're in the situation where it's so desperate there's no way out. So there was some scoffing at that legislation. There was some ideas that it was totally unnecessary. So what I wanted to do was reach out to school districts to find out perspectives from the counselors on the ground. So I circle back and I contact Valley View School District. And something they told me related specifically to the social emotional learning, which is what they did is they received these 30 slots within the school district for professional development. And that's not just teachers, it's administrators, it's bus drivers, it's the people who are cleaning the schools.
Staff,
right.
Basically.
Anybody who works for the school district. And what they chose to do was forego the typical opportunities for career advancement and dedicate this year's 30 slots specifically to trauma-enhanced learning and social-emotional learning, because it was a problem that they recognized that they specifically wanted to target. And the counselors are excited about it, because the counselors, of course, want every opportunity for other people to recognize these signs. And when you think about a child who is in this desperate need for help, to think that maybe a school bus driver can recognize that sign, right? Like that's
right.
It's not something that necessarily would jump in your mind as somebody who needs that training. But of course, this person's getting off the school bus at their home, where a lot of times these problems lie. They're the last person to see the person, or the first person to see them in the morning. So it's a really unique and interesting way, but it also speaks to the perceived need for this funding in the first place, that there isn't this designated fund to help for these trainings. So these teachers and staff are foregoing other career advancement to focus on trying to make their school safer.
And where are they getting that money from for this?
It comes from the state. It's okay. A separate fund.
That it's
comes
a separate
from
fund?
The state. Yeah. So they get these 30 slots for career advancement.
And they can use it for whatever they want when it comes to that.
Yeah, and they're focusing it.
So talk a little bit more about the conversation that was had in the State House, because this was even on the governor even talked about this being a necessity when this was brought up,
right,
to get this, you know, social and emotional training to look at kids' mental health basically in schools.
Right. Well, I mean, you mentioned that we've been following these stories and talking about mental health as part of the Finding Hope franchise for the last 2 years. I mean, we have found that this is not a conversation that is specific to the State House, and it's not a conversation that's specific to the inner workings of the GOP in the State House. Like, this is a national conversation, and there are differing opinions on it. So the conversation in committee, there was concern about Barbara Ehart specifically when I went to interview her. Her concerns were, well, aren't we already giving teachers too much? How much can you really train a teacher to be the person? And I understand that, because we have the same conversation about police officers, for instance, that are we really relying on police officers to be clinicians and counselors, right? However, it's part of their job. And if it's going to be part of their job, that training, especially perceived by the teachers and the teachers union and the individuals who are on the ground in that way, they want that type of training. They're asking for that type of training. So the State Department of Education, specifically the Superintendent of Public Instruction, Sherry Ibarra, she had that as a line item when she was making her pitch to the Department of to the Education Committee, saying, this is something we need. This is something we need to fund. And members of the committee were less than receptive to it. And one legislator made comments that when he was a kid, students were just taken behind the woodshed, and that would take care of the problem. There was scoffing about the idea, you know, it's so touchy-feely, this social emotional learning. What does that really mean? Is it a concerning slippery slope to, you know, teaching kids liberal feelings and things like that. That's one of the concerns is what is really social emotional learning? How do we confirm what that looks like before we start just training teachers and having them overstep their bounds? Because maybe parents want to be consulted. Maybe it's not as easy as just having a counselor sit down with a student that the parents need to be involved, right? There are a lot of other concerns that are involved. Mm-hmm. It's not as simple and cut and dry as they just don't care about mental health. I didn't get the feel that that was their perspective. However, as I mentioned, the school districts and the Department of Education that we spoke to are wholly in favor of this. And Valley View School District going beyond even this piece of legislation to find their own way to fund it speaks to where they saw the value. Right.
Well, that's the thing. When school districts are finding their own ways around this to make sure that they get the training that they need.
Of course.
I want to switch gears. Don, we know this has been a huge topic of conversation is home prices, home values, property taxes, all of that. In Boise, they hit a record high when it came to home prices recently, but this isn't necessarily good news because the cost of living is not equal to that.
Yeah. So, I mean, I try and take a really measured approach at Boise Dev to the current situation and not hype it up and get excited about Californians moving here or get excited about, boy, this is the worst ever, because people need facts to be able to form their opinions. But when you look at that, the median price of a house in Ada County, it's important to say that the median is not an average, but the point at which half of the homes are above and half of the homes are below, that number stood at $363,000 in January. That's an increase of $46,000 in a single year, so about 14.5%. I also ran a story from our friends at the Star News of McCall, and the median price of a home in McCall now stands at $400,000. It's actually, I'm sorry, $406,000 if you want to get really, really tricky there. But more than that, if you look at Cascade, that community, this is just stunning. In the last 2 years, the median home sales price in the Cascade area went from $155,000 to $267,000. That's
oh my gosh,
72% rise. Now, that's driven by a number of factors, people buying second homes, the recovery in the economy around Tamarack, even though that's actually in the Donnelly submarket. But you have a lot of people who live in those communities in the mountain towns who are service workers or working in industry up there. And it's a problem we're seeing around the state. Now, you mentioned cost of living. I looked at the housing data. I looked at the rent data. I looked at the in-migration. But I also looked at that cost of living. And for now, cost of living in the Boise metro area is actually still slightly lower than the national average. I think sometimes it doesn't feel like that, and the conversation gets a little overheated. And housing actually is still below the national average. It's actually 23.5% below the national average. So it definitely has gone up in comparison to the history for this area, but it is still more affordable than a lot of the nation. However, the local association of realtors, the real estate agents group here in Boise, says that they expect home prices to go up another 8% this year. It's important to point out that that forecast was put together and came out before this week's dramatic shift in the stock market. I think it's beyond my analysis expertise, but I do think that that has potential to change the calculation a little bit. We'll see. We'll know more in a year. But it's definitely a time of great change in Boise, and it's getting more expensive for just about everybody.
And then, how renters play into this.
Yeah, and boy, and even just looking at those rent figures and not, it's not just Boise, but if you look at some of the other areas, in Eagle, for instance, the average rent is $1,295. That's a 44% bounce over the prior year. It's actually the highest percentage increase. And even if you look at somewhere like Caldwell, which I think a lot of people used to look at as kind of far out, we were talking about this earlier. Mm-hmm. The average rent has topped $1,000 for the first time, and it's up 18% over the prior year. In fact,
more than $1,000 in Caldwell to rent.
And that's the average. But in the 1, 2, 3, 4, in the 7 cities that Rent Cafe, where I got this data, tracks, all of them in the Treasure Valley are over $1,000. And actually, the most expensive right now, Meridian.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay, before we wrap up, the latest with the Boise Boys from HGTV.
Yeah, so the Boise Boys is a popular national program on HGTV that, speaking of the Boise housing market, tends to flip homes. Ostensibly, they buy a house and they flip it and resell it. This last season, you saw them do a project in the North End that took three, a triplex unit of affordable units and turned it into one luxury housing unit. But they've also been listing some of their products on Airbnb, including one over by M&W Market in the East End. At the end of the episode says, we've got an offer on this house and we hope to sell it. Well, they never did sell it. They kept it. It's owned by them. It's on Airbnb. In fact, I could find no record that they ever listed it. That doesn't mean that they didn't. They could have done a private listing or whatever, but it is interesting. They certainly are a symbol, I think, of a rising market mm-hmm. here. They're working on a new show with High Noon Entertainment, the company behind the popular Fixer Upper show that features Chip and Joanna Gaines. And that show will be a remodel show. So if you have a home here in the Treasure Valley for a family, you can apply to be on the show. The catch is you have to have at least $75,000
right.
to remodel yeah. your home.
Mike just shook his head in disbelief. No, yeah. you really do. Yeah. You have to have, that's what it says right in the thing. You have to have that.
That's a minimum. It says it should be proportional to the changes that you need for the home. So we'll see. We'll see where that goes, and we'll see how that show comes out. But it's pretty interesting right now to watch a show focus on Boise, bring national spotlight to Boise, and deal with the dynamics of a tight housing market. Yeah.
I want to thank all of you for coming in today. Our panel, Don Day with BoiseDev.com, Heath Drusen with Boise State Public Radio and Guns in America, and Mike Sharp with KIVI 6 on your side. Always good to have you guys in.
Thank you so much.
Good weekend.
This is Idaho Matters.